Everyone likes the idea of a new start. It's a great way to leave problems behind. Maybe you move home, new location. You can have some new neighbours. Maybe it's an easier journey to work. A new job. You can move on from maybe the boss or the colleagues that you found really irritating. Maybe to something more interesting, something better paid. Maybe you fancy a new relationship. You can start fresh. You don't have the baggage of those old arguments, those ways that you feel you weren't really compatible. We like a new start. We want a new government. You know, let's have a change. But does it work? Well, yes, you can get rid of some problems. But the trouble is, we usually just swap them for different problems. Because then there's things you don't like in your new job. There's problems in your new house. But the biggest problem is that as you change the circumstances, you don't change. You're still the same. The circumstances are different. You haven't changed. You still have the same weaknesses, the same fears, the same desires. You still make the same mistakes. And we all come with baggage. The past shapes you, and it follows you. Sin leaves a trail, doesn't it? A bit like Abel's blood that was on the ground that we read about. Sin leaves a trail, and you can't escape that, and you can't undo it. So we have the baggage of guilt and regret, of loss maybe, bitterness, and sometimes a blindness actually to our real problem, our real character. Well, welcome to the world of Genesis 4, because here we have a new start. New location, they're outside the garden. There's new work. There's the work of parenthood, the work of being a shepherd. The same relationship, Adam and Eve didn't have a lot of option there. It was only the two of them. But there is something new. There's a baby. The first time a human being is born. The first childbirth, imagine that. Fresh start, full of hope. Maybe they were thinking, is this the child that will be the rescuer? Remember that promise in Genesis 3:15 of this child that would come, that would be the rescuer? Would this child be that person? You know, everyone when they have a newborn baby has great dreams for their child. And surely there's nothing more innocent than a newborn baby. And yet look here. The first child, or at least the first child that is mentioned, grows up to be a murderer. Is that what they had in mind when Cain was born? You see, there's a new start here, but there's a bigger problem. And as soon as you have more people, you have more problems. We're going to have more of that in the rest of the chapter. And so what we find in Genesis chapter 4 is actually the same pattern that we saw in Genesis chapter 3. We find very similar words. We find similar questions. We find a similar judgment. It's just that everything has got worse. You're now starting from the outside. And so you have this problem of that sin is this thing that contaminates. You see, you're now born sinful. Adam's sin is passed on. When Eve was in the Garden of Eden, she needed someone from outside to tempt her. For Cain, it just comes from within. Sin also complains. In Genesis 3, Adam accepts his punishment. Cain complains. Cain is in fact incredibly arrogant and rude in his conversation with God. Sin also brings complexity. As you read through Genesis 4, there's a lot of things that are said where it's not totally clear what is meant. If you read the Hebrew, it can be read in different ways, and the context can't always help you to work out quite what's right. For example, when Eve says in verse 1, "With the help of the Lord, I've brought forth a man," is she speaking there in faith, in dependence on God? God's help, I've done this. It could also almost be translated, "Oh, look, I'm like God. I've made a man. Or is it maybe a mixture of the two? It's ambiguous. And sin always creates that ambiguity. We can never be totally sure what someone means. We can never be totally sure of someone's true motive. There's now options once you have sin. So we can never be totally sure. And of course, sin is complicated as well because of the consequences, isn't it? Sin always makes life complicated. Rather less subtly, you know, how's Cain going to deal with the consequences of the murder? How's he going to deal with the body? How's he going to explain this to Adam and Eve? There's always complexity that comes with sin. And there's also competition. You see, now in Genesis 4, it's no longer just me and God. Now there's people. So sin is now against people. They're in competition. Cain and Abel are not in harmony, but they're competing with each other. So things have got worse. And we are descendants of Adam and Eve, as much as Cain and Abel were. In other words, the problems that they had are the same as the problems that we have. Every human being is born outside Eden. We inherit these same problems. And so, yes, we can have new starts, but we always have this same choice. We always have the same two ways to live that Adam and Eve had in the garden. These two ways of either trusting God or trusting yourself. Let's see how that's worked out with Cain and Abel. First of all, Cain is not Abel. That's not complicated, is it? They're both sons of Adam. They both work hard. They both worship. They're both religious. They both bring offerings to God, but they are different. They have different jobs. One's a shepherd, one's a farmer. They bring different offerings. And there's no hint here that that was a problem. Cain is never rebuked for bringing the wrong offering. Later on in the Bible, you could have sacrifices of grain and of fruit, as well as meat offerings. Rather, it seems that their different offerings symbolize a different heart towards God. And maybe that's hinted at in what is spoken about Abel's offering. He's bringing the fat portions. He's bringing the firstborn. He's bringing the best. It comes from a heart of delight in God. Because when God looks at these offerings, notice the language. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering. But on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. For God, the issue is the person who is bringing the offering. There's something right with Abel. There's something wrong with Cain. And when you read on in the New Testament, that's made very clear. Abel is someone that trusted God. The problem with Cain is that he was someone wicked. Proverbs 15, verse 8. The Lord detests the sacrifice of the wicked. You can bring a wonderful sacrifice, but if your heart is wrong, that's not acceptable to God. And we can see Cain's heart when we see his reaction to God here. This is what brings out Cain's problem. And it's his reaction to God's choice. Because God here chooses Abel, not Cain. So if you like, the problem is Cain isn't Abel. And that really upsets him, doesn't it? He is very angry. And his anger is directed at God, not at Abel in the first instance. Cain expects God to be pleased with him. His name, just like in English, his name in Hebrew sounds like the word gain, and it's the same in English, Cain and gain. And he thought his offering should gain favor from God. In other words, he was sort of taking this path of religion, thinking, well, look, God owes me.
I've done my bit, God owes me. And he really hates the fact that God is free to do as he pleases. He can't manipulate God. That's his problem. God chooses to do as he pleases. He chooses to accept Abel's offering. It's a little bit like Jesus' parable of the owner in the vineyard, where the owner says, "Now, don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money?" And Cain objects to that. He is really objecting to the fact that God is in charge, that God chooses, that God doesn't actually need to justify himself. I think that's why we're not given a direct explanation here of what the problem was. God doesn't need to justify himself. In the end, Cain hates Abel because God has chosen Abel, not him. There's jealousy. And there's a very direct application to us, because there's loads of things in our lives that are down to God's choice. You didn't choose your parents. You didn't sort of do something to earn a certain set of parents. You didn't choose where you were born. You could have been born in a refugee camp in Syria. You didn't choose your body, the illnesses that you would have. You didn't choose your gifts, what you're good at. You won't choose how long that you live. And the problem is, you see, we can become jealous of those who seem to have it better, who have the looks or the gifts or the character that you crave, that actually you think you deserve. It's not fair, you say. Why should they have those gifts? Why should they have those opportunities? And that jealousy and hatred that we can have in our hearts towards others for the things and the gifts and the situation they have really actually starts with God. We're hating his choice. We're saying, why give it to them, not me? This is unfair. When David sinned with Bathsheba, he was really complaining to God, why did you give Bathsheba to Uriah, not to me? That's not fair. His sin was against God. So the test of our true heart to God is how we respond when we don't understand, when we don't like God's choice. Do we trust, or do we try and sort things out in our own hands? Do we try, like Cain, to be God ourselves? Because Cain here murders. He steals what belongs to God. He steals life. He tries to take charge of the choice. If you're going to choose Abel, well, I'll get rid of Abel, and I'll try and sort this out myself, is what Cain is thinking. And it's actually that sin that is bigger than his sin of murder. So he's angered by God's choice. But also, he's not able in another sense. God warns him in verse 7. If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it. This is the first mention of the word sin in the Bible. And sin here is described not as something to sort of snigger about, but it's as a monster, like the triffids we were talking about before. This is a lot more than just breaking a rule. This is the picture is like a sort of wild animal that's trying to ambush you. An animal that desires your destruction. This is something lethal. And the whole point is, Cain isn't able to master him. Cain isn't able to master sin. Rather, the sin eats him. It eats him up. The jealousy eats him up. Because immediately after he's given this warning by God, directly nonetheless, he plans murder. The very next verse. So Cain is very good at manipulating people and situations, just like us. We're very clever in getting what we want. We can do it through flattery. We can do it through fear. We can do it through force. But one thing we can never manipulate is the monster of sin. We think we're in control. We think, oh, I'll never do that again. Oh, you know, I've learned my lesson. But sin constantly defeats us. We're overpowered.
So Cain can win his battle with Abel.
He could even go into an argument with God. But he loses his battle with sin.
That's the lesson we need to learn.
It's interesting, isn't it? The Bible's focus here is very different to ours. If we were writing this, our interest is in the rules. You know, what are the rules? What's the right sacrifice? You know, give us the criteria, give us the rules. Doesn't tell us. Or we want to know, well, this murder, you know, how actually did this happen? How was he killed? You know, what did he do with the body? What did he say to Adam and Eve? We want to know the details. But the Bible just skips over all of that because its focus is on Cain's sin. His anger to God, his hatred to God. His sin is a problem within. Because the outward action here of murder reflects a corrupt heart. It's what Jesus constantly taught, by their fruit you will know them. You know, a good tree produces good fruit, a bad tree produces bad fruit. In the end, your actions betray what's really going on in your heart. And it's why in the New Testament, actually quoting the example of Cain and that warning, in 1 John 3, talks about how the test of true love to God is how we love our brothers. Brothers now in the church. Don't claim you love God if you don't love your brothers in the church. So Cain was religious. He worshipped. He even brought sacrifice, but he didn't have true faith. He didn't love his brother. And even though he's overpowered by sin, he's responsible for his sin. Cain is still responsible. He's accountable for his actions. And Cain doesn't like that. Cain wants to be he wanted to be God, not the image of God. In other words, Cain wanted to decide what was good and evil. He wanted to decide how the world should be organized. He wanted to decide so that the world could be a place where he, Cain, the firstborn, was first, not Abel. But what he didn't want to do is take responsibility for his decisions, just like us. He wanted power, but not responsibility. And God comes to him with exactly the same question that he comes to Adam. Where? But Cain responds differently to Adam. He responds with an outright lie. When God asks, where's Abel? He says, I don't know. It's a lie. And then he responds in sarcasm to God. He basically says, am I my brother's keeper? He's really saying, am I the shepherd's shepherd? There's a real sarcastic tone to this. Nothing to do with me. And he's just murdered him. You know, this is pretty brazen, isn't it? To God, of all people. Who's he kidding? So he's trying to evade responsibility. But God responds very coolly with facts. There's blood on the ground. There's evidence. There's no sort of question about this. You're guilty, Cain. And Cain knows exactly what he's doing. There is something premeditated about this. He has a plan because he gets Abel out into this field somewhere alone. And that must have involved deceit, mustn't it? He wouldn't have said to Abel, oh, let's just go out together and so I can murder you. You know, he has to come up with some sort of scheme, and actually we don't know what he asked. This is sort of a thing that's been added probably when he says, you know, let's go out to the field. We don't know quite what he said to Abel. But he must have deceived him. He's very clever. He's thought about this, and let's go to a place where there's no one to, where he can cry out for help. And his conversation with God is very clever, isn't it? It's clever how he's trying to shift the blame, how he's trying to evade responsibility. There's a high level of intelligence here. Just as we see with Adam. When God asks the question, where are you, to Adam, Adam realizes that isn't a question about his location. It's actually a question about what he's done. That's a very advanced use of language.
It's like someone saying, it's warm in here, and someone responding by opening a window. You didn't say, go and open a window, but you're sort of reasoning it through and working it out, oh, I'll go and do that. That's what they're asking for. Indirect communication through language, that's very clever. You find poetry in Genesis 2. Adam comes up with a poem about Eve. Eve comes up with this wordplay about Cain. This is all jolly clever stuff. Why am I saying this? In the Bible, the first humans are anything but primitive. This is totally different to the picture we get from evolution. The whole point is about these first humans is actually they were more intelligent than we were. Why does this matter? It means that sin does not originate with sort of brutish oafs who could hardly string a sentence together. You know, they were too stupid to know any better. That isn't where sin begins. Sin begins with people who are cleverer than we are. Clever people whose heart is turned against God. And the same is true today. More sin comes from clever people. Think of the ways we've been deceived by supposedly clever people in universities, the sort of things that have come into our society. Where have they all come from? It has come from clever people expressing their rebellion to God in their supposedly clever studies. That's why it's so important we learn how to think as Christians. Sin doesn't come from the stupid, it comes from the clever. And there's something very deliberate about Cain's action here. And also, he's instructed. In Genesis 3, the serpent had to talk Eve into sin. Here, God, no less, tries to talk Cain out of it. God can see where this is going. And so he comes to Cain and says, you know, why are you angry? This is incredible. Cain is having a counseling session with God. God can see Cain has a problem with anger. And he says, come on an anger management course with me, Cain. So before he murders, while Cain is still trying to deal with all these emotions and resentment, God comes to him. Well, with God as your counsellor, this has surely got to work, hasn't it? You know, Cain's going to come out a new man. It's not what we find. God fails as a counsellor. Why does God fail as a counsellor here? Because Cain doesn't want to change. And no counselling will ever work if the person doesn't want to change. If the person doesn't want to take responsibility for their actions. That is a massive lesson to learn. You can say all you like, you can persuade all you like, you can give as much truth as you like. If someone doesn't want to change, nothing can be done. That is scary. Because what if you were that person that doesn't want to change, so sure of yourself, so defiant in your sin, that you won't listen? Cain wouldn't even listen to God. I read this week a verse I've never noticed before in Psalm 58, verse 3. Even from birth the wicked go astray. From the womb they are wayward and speak lies. It comes from within. It says this, their venom is like the venom of a snake, like that of a cobra that has stopped its ears, that will not heed the tune of the charmer, however skillful the enchanter may be. Isn't that incredible? It's saying that the wicked, people like Cain here, are like a snake that stopped its ears, but not even God, as it were, as the charmer, can make them turn. That shows how big a problem sin is. Sin isn't just, oh, I made a mistake, slipped up here. It's a deep problem in our heart, and that is why education isn't the answer. People sort of think, oh, if we educate people better, you know, we can stop war, we can stop greed, we can stop all these other things that are wrong. It won't work. Because the problem is deeper in our hearts. So he's responsible, and that's why he is judged. And he is judged by being made restless. Verse 14, he will become a restless wanderer. The land of Nod is a land that means wandering.
In other words, Cain is a sort of refugee. He's fleeing danger, but he's finding no home. He's got a life that's all new starts. Every day is a new start. But that's bad news because there's no end, there's no home. And just like we've seen before in Genesis 3, the punishment fits the crime. Here the manslayer is driven out from amongst the company of others. And so he's facing a life of not enough. Although his name means gain, now he's missing out. The ground that swallowed Abel's blood now is speaking death to Cain. So the curse that we had in Genesis 3 on the ground is intensified for Cain. He can't even be a farmer. He's going to have to be a scavenger. He's going to have to keep moving on, searching for food. He's left empty. And this is what sin always does. Sin leaves us empty. It sucks out life. It always leaves us wanting more. We are never satisfied. So there's always this drive to do something bigger and better than someone else. Drive for a new adventure, a new start. There's a restlessness in us. What's the proof of that? Well, look at advertising. What does advertising do? It's all about playing on our restlessness, our desire of wanting more, which shows that we don't think we've got enough at the moment, just like Cain. And he's left alone. Cain didn't want company. He didn't want a brother who he felt threatened by, but now he's threatened by others. And this is his problem, you see. If you want to be first, if you want to get the most attention, it's going to come at a price. It's going to come at the price of actually leaving you alone. If you want to be first, the only way is to get rid of the competition. If there's only one entry in a race, you'll get gold. And so the murderer is now fearful of people. He's fearful of the people closest to him. The other children of Adam that would be seeking revenge. And there's an awful picture where he's sort of left alone with himself. This almost self-pity, I think, in verse 13. My punishment is more than I can bear. He's got to focus on himself because there's no one else left to focus on. If he's not his brother's keeper, he's going to have to focus on himself. So he's left restless. There's no peace, there's no security, there's no home. And he's away from God. He talks about being cast out of God's presence, which means he can't enjoy God's rest. What a tragic position to be in. But he's still alive. And you think, hang on a minute, surely as a murderer he should die. And yet God spares him. He doesn't even simply spare him, he protects him. We don't know what this mark is that was placed on him. It doesn't really matter. The key thing is that it protected him. So God here was restraining himself, the sort of monster of sin, the sin that would want to get revenge and further revenge. Here we see the God that cares for the wicked, for those that don't follow him. The God that causes his sun to rise and sends his rain on the evil and the good. This is the God that preserves life. In other words, God is Cain's keeper. So the one who tried to take God's place, the one who killed, is now totally dependent on God for his own life. That's awkward, isn't it? He needs God, but he hates God. And that is the horrible position of everyone who is not a Christian. I think there can be a deep anger inside, because on the one hand, we don't want God, we're trying to ignore God, and yet, deep down, we know that we're actually totally dependent on him for every breath. That's going to leave you miserable. I think actually that is the attraction of euthanasia. It's this idea that somehow we can escape God and this sense that we are dependent upon him. It's almost a last act of defiance. So you need God, but you don't want God. That leaves you miserable. And that's where chapter 4 takes us, isn't it? Things are now worse. Yes, there's a new start, but it's left things worse. The motherhood that it began with has ended in murder. And neither of these two children are the rescuer, because one of them's killed and the other one's the killer. And almost even worse than that, it seems that God isn't doing his job. God has been too kind, surely. God is letting evil prosper. I mean, here's another question for you. Why didn't God stop Abel's murder? God's in control of everything. Why didn't he stop Abel's murder? And then you think, and not only did he not stop Abel's murder, he's provided personal protection to the killer. It's as if God's almost put a bodyguard around the killer. And you think, well, how fair is that? How right is that? How can we make any sense of what's going on here? Well, there's everything in Genesis. It only makes sense in the light of the New Testament, in the light of Jesus. And we can get there as we think about Abel's sacrifice as we finish. You see, as we look at this account, and we could make the mistake of thinking, there's a good guy, there's a bad guy. Told about the bad guy, obviously the lesson is we need to be like Abel. But that, I think, misses the point. Genesis won't allow us to be like Abel, because it says next to nothing about Abel. It's intriguing. His name, Abel, basically means empty, nothing, breath. It's the same word for vanity that you get in Ecclesiastes. And so you find that Abel says nothing. And after bringing this offering, he does nothing except die. All the focus is on Cain. And then you hear nothing of Abel until the New Testament. And he appears in this gallery of heroes in first place in Hebrews 11, where you're told by faith he offered a better sacrifice. Now, if you want to know what faith is, come along this afternoon. Or listen to this. Faith is not something inward that you have. Faith is trust in God. It's trust in what God has said. And it's in particular trust in God when it seems crazy to do so. And we see that in Abel's sacrifice. Remember I said before that both a grain sacrifice and an animal sacrifice were acceptable. So Cain was not wrong to bring grain. But here's the thing. It took great faith for Abel to know that it was right to bring an animal, to kill an animal. This only makes sense if there's no death before sin. But if death has come from sin, animal death is something horrific. I don't know if any of you saw that film, the Noah film a few years ago, in all its weirdness. Well, one thing it really got right was conveying the horror of animal death. There's a point at which someone eats an animal and everyone is absolutely appalled. Because until this point, until after the flood, no one eats animals. And to see a dead animal was a reminder of the curse on sin. So it would be the craziest thing in the world to think that somehow God would be pleased by you killing an animal. And you can almost see that's almost why Cain would be angry. He's saying, look, Abel's done the wrong thing here. He's killed an animal. That's something terrible. And you're pleased with him. Why on earth would Abel do that? He could only do it if he had faith, if he was trusting in something God had said. That's what was incredible at Abel, that he offered this animal. What's going on? Well, God was pleased with Abel's sacrifice because he was pleased with his son's, Jesus' sacrifice. That sacrifice of Abel foreshadows God's answer to sin. Foreshadows God's answer to the injustice of Abel's death, this blood that cries out. And the answer is where we began this service, the blood of Jesus. Hebrews 12:24. You have come to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Jesus wasn't a nothing. He was the Son of God. But like Abel, he's hated for his righteousness. Jesus is hated by the people around him because his life shows them up. It actually reveals their true heart. And so you find people like Cain, religious leaders, people who offered sacrifices like Cain, rejecting Jesus. They kill Jesus, but unlike Abel, his blood is powerful. His blood speaks not death, but life. His blood speaks justice not being overlooked, but justice being done, because Jesus is being punished for sin. This is how we can be forgiven. Jesus is able to save. Abel's blood speaks vengeance, guilt. Jesus' blood speaks not guilty, speaks forgiveness, it speaks life. And so the question for us is, will you share Abel's faith and not try and be like Abel, but trust in Jesus? Who are you looking to? And trust in Jesus crucified. That's crazy, isn't it? Who would trust in a crucified Saviour? And yet that is God's wisdom. It is through Jesus' blood that cleansing and forgiveness is found. And with Jesus, you really can have a new start. It's more than just forgiveness. It's not just that God wipes the slate clean and sends you off on your way. He makes you a new person with a new future. And like Abel, and like Jesus, you will be hated in this world if you belong to Jesus. You will sometimes be treated as a nothing. You may even be killed. But you will be at home with God. Look at what Jesus has done. Look at his blood. That is the answer. We need to trust in him.